What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Also, we have an update for you. During the interview, you'll hear Ann Jack refer to Heather Heyer, the woman who was killed when she was mowed down by a driver, as a wobbly or a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. That was the information that was available at the time. It's now not clear that she was a wobbly or in the IWW, but I'm keeping in the story that I tell towards the end of the interview about another wobbly because I think it's still relevant and poignant. Welcome to a special breaking news episode of the Katie Halper Show that we did with reporter Jack Smith, who is a senior writer at Mike, and he is coming to us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Make sure that you become Patreon supporters. Go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow so you can hear our extended interview with Jack Smith. Welcome, Jack.
Hey, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for talking to me. And people may be following you on Twitter because you've been really consistently tweeting about this. Jack's Twitter handle is Jack Smith. What is it?
IV the fourth. Do you know my name?
I do, but I just want Jack Smith IV. The only, the least Jewish name, the least ethnic name probably in my entire phone.
I knew that we were going to get into ethnography like really rapidly on my first Katie Halper Show appearance.
Of course, and thank you for coming. We've been wanting to have you on, and you know, people who are listening to this are definitely listening. There is a huge, you know, white pride, whatever you want to call it, Nazi, we're going to get into what to call in a second. There was a Nazi rally basically today, and people are definitely tuning in because they want to hear me make jokes about you know, Jewish jokes. The filet fish. Yeah. White fish, that's definitely why people want to talk to.
By the way, your people were out there today, like a lot of, there were a lot of Jewish guys especially at this rally were the kind to be right up in the white nationalist faces, being like, I'm a Jew, come and fucking get a piece of this, and like really flashing like tattoos and stuff at them, which is also
what kind of tattoos?
Like,
this Jew kills fascists.
Yeah, well, like Stars of David and stuff, which you guys aren't allowed to do technically, I suppose.
I don't know, not religious, but I guess not. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not.
I know that mostly from Curb Your Enthusiasm, when the mom can't get buried in a spoiler alert in a Jewish cemetery because she has a tattoo on her ass. They learn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In the meantime, let me talk to you. You started in a really interesting place, which is like what to call this rally.
Yes.
And I want to like clarify because a lot of people are trying to define it. One of the really messy things here is watching mass media. You know, I wouldn't say I'm among one of the better alt-right reporters, but I do it often enough that you sort of get used to parsing out some of the finer points of what these individuals believe, what they purport, and what sort of how to distinguish between the intentional layers of irony they put between their expressions of their politics and what they sincerely believe. Anyway, so what this really is in the couple months leading up to this rally, there is sort of a thinning of the ranks of the alt-right. You know, the alt-right is the quote alt-right is an umbrella term that gets loosely applied to like sort of dozens of different groups, like anything from like you know, these guys with handles like Pepe Himmler 1388, who just like trigger liberals online or whatever, straight along the way to like Proud Boys and actual neo-Nazis and shit. So it's a pretty diverse group. And sort of what's been happening is some of the more super Trumpy media types and the 4chaners and the internet trolls have sort of been finding themselves slowly pushed out of this movement, and the serious nationalists and the white supremacists and the white identitarians basically saying, you got to be on board for a unified message around white identity, or you need to, like, get the fuck out of the way, basically. So that's what this – that's what the purpose of this rally is. And a lot of people think, oh, is it white supremacy? Is it pro-Trump? Well, you know, a lot of the people out there at this rally are saying things to us and saying things to the camera. And we spoke to a bunch of people, including, you know, Matthew Heimbach of Traditionalist Worker Party. I spoke to David Duke briefly, who will tell you, look, we identify with parts of Trumpism, the nationalist, the border wall, repeal of DACA, anti-immigrant policies, the real nationalist stuff that resonates with sort of the ethno-identitarians of both the Confederate South and sort of like the online right and the young aggrieved sort of millennial neo-masculines and the white identitarians. Anyhow, but what's important to realize coming out of this event is the purpose of their declaration is we're a unified group. We have a platform of nationalism, specifically around white identity, and we want to hold Trump accountable to these things. And Trump is very weak on these things. He's weak on these points that he was all about on the campaign trail and that he used to draw us into his movement. Well, we want to be an internal opposition party. We want to pull Trump and the Republicans further to the right. Matthew Heimbach, that sort of gruffer head of the Traditionalist Workers Party, he's a real far-right figurehead in this movement. He said, Trump isn't draining the swamp. Trump is filling the swamp even further. He is pro-bourgeois. He's a pro-capitalist, and that's everything that we're against. So that's sort of to clear up what this rally is about. It's a declaration of intent, and that intent is to drive Republicans further and further to the right and into nationalism and holding Trump accountable to his campaign promises.
So these are people – it's interesting because I noticed that Trump did condemn it. And I was kind of surprised. I thought he'd avoid it, like he has.
I've been keeping up, but he condemned hate, right?
Right.
I'm gonna make a comparison.
He did not explicitly. Yeah, go.
I'm gonna make a comparison that's funny because I saw. I don't know if you were going. I'm gonna make it relevant for your audience.
Thanks.
Because Neera Tanden, tweeted out that progressives need to focus on the right enemy right now. Did you see that one? Did you engage with that?
Yeah, I responded to it a bunch, yeah.
And now what she said is, hey, I'm just calling for unity, right? And it's like when I don't mean to compare Neera Tanden to Trump, but when Trump did something like condemning hate, what you're doing is you're making a vague enough statement that you have plausible deniability around what you're actually saying, such that whoever that message is falling on, they'll pick it up and make it politically useful. You know, Trump's statement isn't useful to that Trump comes out and says we must end hate and violence on both sides isn't useful for the left. It's useful for the right.
Right. I mean, to be clear, I have no – it's not like all of a sudden maybe I need to rethink this whole Trump thing.
Yeah.
That for Trumpian – by Trumpian standards, his even saying anything – but I think that it makes sense if we look at what you were saying, which is that these people are not Trump allies. They kind of overlap with him in certain areas. But for them, he's way too – he's what? He's not nationalist enough. He's not right-wing enough. He's too – you know, I mean, then these things get complicated, right? Like, where's the right? Where's the left? Not that you or I ever talk in those stupid terms of horseshoe theory, but when we're talking about right-wing movements, you know, there's more populist, more nationalist, more racialist, and then there can be more free market, and then it gets kind of complicated.
But it isn't just one spectrum or one delineation or one shape of these things. They run along different dimensions. And by the way, actually, real quick, can I comment on that one thing you just said about horseshoe theory movement? People are so funny, and they see, like, they just don't understand how left populism and right populism can be different. What they do, which is interesting, is because, you know, the center sees critiques of itself, and they see the same critique levied at them from both sides, and because they are not focused on, they're focused on defense of their particular status quo and not on solutions and what politically is being proposed, what we get is a critique-based understanding of these groups, such that the left populists and the right populists have the same critique of why the center is shitty, and therefore they might as well be the same groups, even though they have totally opposite ideas of how to replace them.
Right.
Not that difficult an idea to understand.
And it also, I mean, this is something that came up a lot with the Bernie Trump comparisons. It's like, if you appeal to angry white men, you are the same thing. And I know I've said this on so many different occasions, so I apologize if I sound like a broken record, but it's incredible to me that we have to still say this. Like, you want to appeal to angry white men, but you want to say to them, don't hate Muslims and Mexicans, hate inequality and structural inequality. And that the rich don't pay taxes. I mean, those are so fundamentally opposing. And what centrists don't get is that when you don't have a competing ideology that appeals to these people, you have a vacuum on the left. And then you have a very scary, charismatic thing going on the right. It's so odd.
Getting back to the rally, in the lead up, new proposal of a common platform, which is kind of what the Unite the Right is about, there was a lot of confusion at many of these protests. I remember particularly in Boston when it was more like, it wasn't a pro-right, it was just kind of like an anti-Trump. You know, it was just a bunch of people trying to provoke, basically. It was a combination of like these alt-night types and Proud Boys trying to draw anti-fascists into a battle. You would have people on the left chanting things like, you know, before the right, this particular right faction stood for something cohesively, you'd have left chants of, on the Hill, people would chant things like, we will not give up the fight. Something like, we will not give up the fight. Healthcare is a human right. And you'd have people in the far right crowd say things like, I don't know, I think that's pretty much right. Like, I think that sounds good. Or you would have them doing the same chant at the same time, which is weird, like the I believe that we will win chant. Or you would have, you know, the left would start like, one leftist would start like playing really anti-media songs, like the anti-flags press corps, and like the right would come over and high-five that guy.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, because the right, this right movement that was called the alt-right, had so little ideological cohesion that it sort of left people with nothing but their individual politics, but also their sort of like collective senses of grievance and common enemy, which you know, when that's all you have, you know, that's not really what a political ideology is. It can generate political grievance, can generate political opinion, but I think it's one of the things that we see in general in the media, which is in lieu of pro-Trumpism, we just see kind of like anti-Trumpism.
Because Trump himself is so ideologically kind of all over the place and not very disciplined and not very ideological, right?
Yeah. So then today, right? So
okay. Yeah. We're like, let's just talk about like philosophy, political philosophy, you know, what is neocon versus neoliberal? Meanwhile, you're like in Charlottesville. It's
yeah.
Kind of hilarious.
No,
I mean, it's not funny, but you know, yeah. Let's stay grounded because you're on the ground.
Let's keep to it.
Yeah.
So early in the day, obviously, almost everything went down before the rally was even meant to begin. But there was hours of it. I mean, we were out there at 9 a.m. and there were a good 3 hours of prep work. And basically, the real conflict began. I think what the right might have been anticipating, and what often happens at these events, is the anti-fascists will try to get in people's face. There will be a little bit of skirmish, but because the right wing has the protest permit, they're protected. Mm. So what ends up happening is the leftists get driven away because they are not having a permitted demonstration. And then the right gets to stay, and the right gets to declare themselves a victory because the cops did the work for them. In this case, what happened was a skirmish, and I've got a lot of this on Twitter. The right-wing groups were not good at communicating to each other about how to get into the park. So they kept going to the wrong fucking places. And not to the entrance, which was in the middle of a...
Can you set this up for us as if we have no idea what the kind of logistics and the layout is and what this protest was about, what the park was?
Definitely. So the park was Lee Park. It was Robert E. Lee Park, but Lee Park with the Robert E. Lee statue. And this, in I believe it was in April, the city of Charlottesville decided, we're renaming this park Emancipation Park and taking down the Confederate monuments. The Confederate monuments are a sort of a stain on what this town was. Charlottesville is a city that was under, I believe, Confederate control, but not in the Confederacy. And basically what we know about why these Confederate statues were put up historically is not because they liked the Confederacy at the time or it was a Confederate area, but because it sort of reinforced culture around Jim Crow laws. These things were erected well after the Civil War during the Jim Crow era. So these are sort of a relic that binds those two eras together, both dark times, and represent very clearly what they do. So basically what happened is the right, led by a local, I believe he was, maybe he was a Daily Caller contributor, I don't know, Jason Kessler, decided he would get sort of the A-list of white nationalist speakers to hold a rally with the theme, a common nationalist chant, "You Will Not Replace Us," which works on the historical angle, but also very directly the far-right paranoia that white supremacists, the far-right paranoia that the white man is being replaced through genocide via immigration and multiculturalism. So this park was, there was a battle about whether or not it would be held in this park. This park is fairly small. It is, I believe, 1.4 acres in a town. Remember, this event was set to draw 1,000, you know, anywhere from between 3,000 to 6,000 people in a town that only has a population of, I believe, about 30,000. So it was just like going to be basically a powder keg. They tried to move it and it didn't get moved. And it didn't get moved as of like late last night. I mean, we're talking like it was only in the hours before the rally was going to go on that we really knew it was going to happen. So early in the morning, anti-racist protesters, anti-fascist protesters, Black Lives Matter, Jewish protesters on the front, clergy took the front lines, which was fucking cool, and sort of did their heckling as the far-right groups kind of made their way in, and there were chants back and forth and the usual taunting, everything you'd expect, right? So the groups present are everyone from... you know, a large contingent of what we think of as Southern nationalists, so Confederates, people, you know, what you think of as like the KKK, sort of that old vanguard of Southern Confederate white nationalists, explicit white identitarian groups like Identity Europa, which is a sort of new, very young white identity fraternity that is meant to be very sleek and look very fresh. And has a small contingent. It's the group that Richard Spencer most often sort of pals around with. They provided ad hoc security detail to him in D.C. at sort of a precursor rally to this one about a month ago. They brought in, so we've got those kind of groups, and then we've got Traditionalist Workers Party and Vanguard America, and this is like where we start to get into the territory of like, you know, Appalachian and Midwestern white identitarian white nationalist, but of a sort of darker much more explicitly, I guess you'd call it like an explicitly white nationalist, white identitarian, pro-worker, sort of the newest vanguard of what would usually be like compound neo-Nazis, led by Matthew Heimbach. Matthew Heimbach famously started the White Student Union at, I believe, Georgetown when he was in college. He's sort of seen as a Confederate, sort of the new leader of the new Confederacy. So these are the players, these are the groups. One of the things that started the conflict, basically to sum up the conflicts in short, is Heimbach and the traditionalist workers got cornered on their way to the rally. They basically took a wrong turn and got cornered. And that, when they got cornered, they were pressed further and further back. Some speakers that are very popular in white identitarian circles, like Baked Alaska and Chris Cantwell, got pepper sprayed viciously, pushed further and further back. And obviously there was violence on both sides. And, you know, people... That would have been anti-fascists and protesters and anti-racist protesters and people on the street. Now, to be clear, ahead of time, there was so much work done by local organizers, anti-racist organizers, Black Lives Matter organizers, who I've spoken to today and in the weeks leading up to the rally, even who communicated with people on the militia side. And by the way, we also have the militias here. The militia movement really doesn't identify with the white nationalist movement. In fact, the white nationalist movement and the militia movement are very at odds. White nationalists believe in an ethno-state. They are not big fans of the Constitution, always. And the militia movement is very pro-constitutionalists. They often get shit for kind of being criticized as racist, and oftentimes those criticisms land in the way that they carry themselves, in the way that they behave, in some of the intonations their leaders use. But they're pretty explicitly against sort of the Richard Spencer breed of white nationalist. When I was in Boston a few months ago, and I spoke to Oath Keepers founder L. Stuart Rhodes, he said something I thought was frighteningly savvy in the way he inverted this language. You know, he said, "Oh, those guys, like, you know, when we see those white nationalists, we tell them to take that shit off, because that's identity politics."
Right. That's interesting.
So the militias were standing in here, but the militias also were helpful in keeping the peace.
Oh, interesting. Okay, let's go back then a second. But I do think that what happens is that people conflate militia members having white privilege and being shielded by white privilege and being treated by the police with differently than they would be if they were Black Lives Matters. They conflate that with a real vitriolic racism and white supremacy.
Right, and
which isn't to say that these
people are woke or even non-racist, right. And we're most certainly not anti-racist in their actions.
Doing the work.
Yeah, they're not. Yeah, they're not doing the work. But they are on their face and in their messaging. You know, if you ask them, you know, what are you doing protecting these guys? What they'll say is, you know, oftentimes many of them will say, like, look, I find these guys disgusting or whatever, but like, you know, we're protecting the Constitution, we're protecting speech. Of all the people who claim free speech shit out here in these streets, right? The 4chaners and the National Review's protecting Google Bro and his memo. Like, of all the people who talk shit on free speech, Oath Keepers get it pretty close as far as the right goes. They really are into keeping the peace on both sides. But they also have this, like, belief that Antifa are like a communist thing that threatens the country. They're a little bit out of touch with what they consider the threat in America. They actually believe that, you know, communism is it's just like very Cold War and strange. You know, it's an aging movement. And the white nationalists refer to them, by the way, as Boomer Antifa, which is anyway, the infighting, we could talk all fucking day about the infighting, but there was a lot of work done to keep it nonviolent. However, this skirmish broke out. pepper spray, water bottles thrown back and forth. And basically what happened was, instead of the cops coming and clearing away the anti-fascists and letting the rally go on, which they could have done, which is what usually happens, where the police come in and they're like, fuck it, anti-fascists, get the hell out of here and leave these white nationalists alone. Instead, what the cops and the National Guard and the state troopers did was they were like, everything is an unlawful assembly. We tried to move you out of this park to begin with. All this shit is over. Get the fuck out of the park. Everybody clear the streets. Downtown is in a state of emergency. Nearly every building closed. And they were like, everybody out. Everybody gone. And kind of what happened is the white nationalists were driven out past the anti-racist protesters who stuck around and cheered. And I posted one video that some people thought was very powerful, where you see the militia receding into the alleyways and you see the traditionalist worker party sort of routed and running down the street or whatever away from the rally. And then the flags, the red flags and Black Lives Matter sign and the DSA flag sort of flying up on the hill, which was powerful for many people. Now, this is the point in the day at which people felt pretty good, because it was, I believe, about, you might call it, this might have been about 1 p.m., I think. Mm-hmm. At 1 p.m., people are celebrating. The park has been cleared. State of emergency has been declared. There have been no serious injuries. Medical dispatch is about a dozen for, you know, scuffles and some cuts and a lot of fucking mace, and there are a lot of chemicals in the air, a lot of people dispersing chemicals. But people felt a very good energy because there were rumors that Richard Spencer was arrested. He wasn't, but there was this feeling that this shit had been wiped out of the system, that the thing had been cleared out, and maybe we think the white nationalists are regrouping at a park far away, but fuck them. And eventually they cleared out of there too. The incident with this vehicle, and I've spoken tonight with multiple people, about half a dozen people who were there, and I have just gotten, I'll be publishing the audio soon, but I've gotten off the phone with a few people who were hit by the car.
Wow.
And this didn't happen until quite a bit later. From what we understand, and this here on the Katie Halper Show might be one of the first places this is going to come out. But what happened was, is there was a there was a rumor that there was a neighborhood, I don't know what neighborhood it is, but a neighborhood to the east of the rally that was a neighborhood that was mostly people of color and mostly poor, and that they were being harassed by white nationalists who had been routed in that direction. And they had asked for backup. So DSA and anti-racist organization, just a bunch of coalitions said, fine, fuck it, we'll march that way. They headed down that way. And then at one point somebody said, actually, they're fine. We're not going over there. We're going to stop this march here and we're not going to, they requested we not actually be over there. Okay, fine. Now there's confusion. And people were just kind of like standing around, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are people who try to drive through the crowd at this point, from what I understand, and then they started getting a little bit of shit over it. Like, they're driving through that crowd a little bit, and the crowd was not really having it and not happy about it. And then the car sort of unexpectedly plowed through a bunch of people. Bunch of people went over the windshield. One person I've seen a video was, she was given CPR until she died. They gave about 10 minutes of CPR.
That was a woman, Heather Hare.
That would have been her, yeah. And there's video available. Taylor Lorenz from Jesus The Hill Christ has a pretty good live video of that. And then there's various videos showing the car. I was not on that block at the time, but we've been speaking to people. So that has changed the tone pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
I don't mean to, I'll put it this way. I don't mean to put a silver lining on it. It's not a silver lining. I want to be clear here. One of the impacts of this death is that, like I said, when we first started the show, this rally had a purpose. which was to create a force that would represent Trump's sort of nationalism and try to hold him and other Republicans accountable to it and show Republicans that there was an interest in those kind of policies beyond sort of dog whistles. You know what I mean? What I think, now what you said is, oh, Trump, maybe he rebuked it or whatever.
But I meant for Trumpian.
But what's interesting here is what has happened is McCain and Bush and Rubio and Christie and Grassley and Bratt and Gardner and Cruz have all come out and super explicitly said, you know, Gardner said, "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name. These were white supremacists, and this was domestic terrorism." Martha Robbie said, "Appalled by unspeakable bigotry and violence and white supremacists in Charlottesville, this hatred is un-American." Had there not been a death, had there not been extreme incidences of violence, it's very possible that Republicans wouldn't be moved to swear off this movement the way they did today. And in fact, one of the things we realize, one of the things we've known for a long time, and one of the things Trump, we've been given, you know, we as Americans, they're progressive, leftist, Democrats, centrists, even other Republicans have been saying for a long time is that Republicans have been sort of passively benefiting from this movement. Yeah, if you press them, they'll say, "I don't like the KKK, all these, you know, we don't like these racists," but they have sort of allowed this many have been criticized as allowing this movement to be fellow travelers, to be not disavowing them in a way that says, we are not a coalition, we don't fuck with you, we are not fellow travelers, we are not political allies, we do not belong next to each other along a spectrum. All of your interests are apart from counterintuitive to and unrepresentative of our interests. And now what's happened is Republicans have come out and drawn a line in the sand and offered a hard rebuke, I think, in a way that steadfastly distances themselves from the far right. I don't know if necessarily these politicians deserve a standing ovation for that, but it's significant in that, I'll tell you what, I'm still in touch with organizers on both sides. I'm going to try to report some more stories. We have some interviews, I believe, that are going to be lined up with the far right speakers, if we can still get them on the horn by the time me and my producer leave town. I'm doing mostly video while I'm here and mostly tweeting. These individuals, many of the speakers, who are usually incredibly eager to be a part of the media and be represented and show up in the platforms and give the interviews, are laying very low. They are very camera shy. They are hunkered down, and I don't think many of them want to be attached to this. I don't think many of them want to seem proud of the events today. And I think that I could be wrong, but I think that they have been realigned in the public eye, perhaps, in a way that will make things much less. Remember, this movement is a movement that thrives on ambiguity. This is a movement that always creates plausible deniability in terms of the dangers of their movement, because they've always been able to say, "Well, the left is the really one that are the ones that kick off the violence." Well, we're not anti-black. We're just pro-white, and that's fine. And for anybody who's looking to be sympathetic to this movement and to build coalition with it and to be fellow traveler to it, those things pass the test often. those things don't require rebuke. And so they've used this ambiguity, they've used this very savvy messaging to allow themselves to persist in public space and allow themselves to be relevant to the movement and allow themselves to be, by the way, what is their usefulness to the media, but to be a proxy for Trumpism, right? To be a proxy.
So, no, I mean, I think what you said, you know, do they really deserve a standing ovation? No, let's not, you know, shower them with praise. But I think the other question is, like, what will the effect of this be? Because I think that sometimes this is great. McCain is condemning hate, but voting with Trump, right? Or they're saying they stand against hate and it's great optics, but they're supporting the policies and programs. What is this? Does this actually matter? So McCain condemns this, Ted Cruz condemns this, and then what happens? Is white supremacy, is neo-Nazism, white nationalism, are these movements neutered? Or do they now have a, even more validity and legitimacy because they're even that much more kind of marginalized and you know, oppressed, or however they would narrate it?
I think the problem is that every this may seem, I don't like to reduce things this way, but I think honestly it's as simple as like, I might have to sneeze here. This is why I'm being weird. I honestly think it's as simple as, for the rest of these individuals' lives and for every attempt they have, every attempt they make to persist in public space, they have to be attached to it. Chris Cantwell and Baked Alaska and Richard Spencer and Mike Enoch and Matthew Heimbach, some of these guys I don't think will be very phased because they already kind of existed at the fringes. Nobody is like confused about where Matthew Heimbach stands. But for all these guys, they're going to have to account for this. They're going to be made to account for this forever. Instead, whereas before, Baked Alaska was a guy who was like, oh, a media guy who was a BuzzFeed employee. And is he part of the alt-right?
Yeah, I don't know
is he part of the alt-right? Well, he says he's not, so maybe he's not. Any of these other individuals. Now, the first thing we know about them is Baked Alaska, or Mike Enoch, or Pax Dickinson, or Chris Cantwell. That guy who was a speaker at the giant white supremacist rally where that woman died, where the guy drove a car into the crowd, where a state of emergency was declared and helicopters crashed and the National Guard was brought in. I mean, this was a I'm trying to be pretty level in this interview. This is a fucking catastrophe. This is a terrible event for everybody involved. It was a foreseeable catastrophe. Everybody had been warning for quite some time that it would be. Death occurred in an environment where 99% of all individuals were working as hard as they could to create a safe environment. This is a stain on the far right going forward for quite some time. This was an event that, like, I put it in line with events like Standing Rock or the airport protests. The nation, one of the things I'm feeling looking around and in the responses I'm seeing on Twitter and stuff like that is there are a few moments in a given year or in history where we kind of get where the country stands. And one of the things that the far right has had for a couple of decades is ambiguity in that space. The far right has been doing quite a bit of work to distance themselves from burning crosses and swastikas and white hoods. Why? Because we feel pretty good about where the nation stands on those things. So they've tried to develop new symbols, and they've tried to create ambiguity, and they've tried to create a new set of philosophies to mainstream this as part of conservative politics for a new generation. this might have been a major fucking unforced error. Because now a lot of people know pretty much where they stand, and a lot of Republicans who might otherwise have been passive allies have made a pretty clear stand against them too. And I think for that, this was a net loss for everyone, but most especially for those who had the most to gain.
Right. It's interesting. She's trending, Heather Heyer. This is the woman who was murdered. And she was with the IWW, so the International Workers' World.
Wobblies, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which is, and we'll get into who they are in a second, but apparently, who know, her final Facebook cover is a quote, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention," which is like making me quite emotional. And the Wobblies, by the way, the Wobblies, Greg Grandin, the historian, put something up on Facebook.
You know, by the way, her April, I'm seeing something right here, her April 2000, you'll like this, her April 2000, her April 12th, 2016 cover photo was Bernie 2016.
Oh, really? For the woman who was killed?
She's one of your
yeah,
ilk.
Okay, mine, yeah. You're such a Hillary.
Because I'm such a Hillary man.
Exactly. And thanks so much for talking to me, Peter Dow. No, let's see. This week in history, the murder of the IWW labor's leader. Little was an American labor leader who was lynched in Butte, Montana for his union and anti-war activities. He joined the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, in 1906, organizing miners, lumberjacks, and oil field workers. He was a member of the union's executive board when he was murdered 100 years ago on August 1st, 1917. Little was born in 1879, the son of a Cherokee mother and a Quaker father. In Fresno, California, he worked as a union organizer with the Western Federation of Miners before becoming active with the IWW. Wow, this is... So, yeah, he was... I'm looking... And Wobbly is the other name for the people
yeah.
who are in the inter...
The IWW is the Wobblies,
international.
Yeah.
It's Industrialized Workers of the World, yeah. Okay, in the early hours of August 1st, 1917, after a speech that the press labeled as a treasonable tirade, six masked men broke into the boarding house where Little was staying. Little was beaten in his room and abducted while still in his underwear. He was bundled into a car which sped away. Little was later... Ugh, this is disgusting. This is disturbing if people don't want to listen to the part. Little was later tied to the car's rear bumper and dragged over the granite blocks of the street. Little was taken to Milwaukee Bridge at the edge of town where he was hanged from the railroad trestle, dying of asphyxiation. A note with the words "first and last warning" was pinned to his thigh, referring to earlier vigilantes giving people three warnings to stop objectionable actions. The note also included the initials of other union leaders suggesting they were next to be killed. And his grave, his tombstone says, "Frank Little, slain by capitalist interests for organizing and inspiring his fellow men." Anyway, sorry, I took us on a
no, I love
there,
a little
but,
history. 1 month before the what did you say? August 1st, 1917?
Yeah.
A couple of months later.
100 years ago.
Russian Revolution.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But yeah, and now Charlottesville is, man, a ghost town. Super eerie.
Were you afraid for your life at any point? Make sure that you become Patreon supporters. Go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow so you can hear our extended interview with Jack Smith.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.